Welcome to those of you who managed to get in. I think this says it all, actually. Those of you who know Stan know that he's not only a wonderful person, but he's one of the world's leading macroeconomists, and, unusually, for the last 7 years, he's been in a position to implement his economics in one of the most powerful positions in the world economy. So if you were looking for the philosopher king, I don't think you would ever find anybody nearer to that than Stan. So where did he learn his economics? At the LSE, of course. He did the BSc and the MSc here. Then he went to MIT, where he did his PhD, and he spent most of his academic career there. He became, I suppose, the leading theorist of the neo-Keynesian school in the 70s and 80s. He also wrote three extremely useful textbooks from which most of us here have learnt a lot. But about 12 years ago, he decided to go into public life, and he became the chief economist at the World Bank. And he did a great deal in the process of reorienting the World Bank towards a concern for poverty, poverty of individuals, as well as poverty of nations. And then he went on from the bank, after a period back at MIT, to the IMF, where he has been the first deputy managing director for the last 7 years. And he's been personally responsible for many of the most important programs in the fund. He retired from the post earlier this year, so we immediately asked him to come and give these lectures. And I was really pleased that before I'd finished the sentence, he said yes. So, Stan, it's lovely to have you here. Stan will speak for about 50 minutes, then we'll have time, 20 minutes or so, for questions. This is, of course, the first of three events, so hopefully all questions can get asked at some point. Stan, thank you so much for coming, and welcome back to LSE. Stan Fisher.
Well, thank you very much, Richard. Nobody ever called me a philosopher before, and nobody ever called me a king before, and nobody ever called me both before either. Ladies and gentlemen, and members of the Robbins family particularly, it's an honor to be invited to deliver these lectures dedicated to the memory of Lord Robbins, and it's an especial honor and a pleasure for me to deliver these lectures at the LSE, where I spent four very happy years from 1962 to 1966, first as an undergraduate, and then taking one of the first or second of the MSc Econ courses. At that time, Lord Robbins taught a course in the history of economic thought, but his influence was more pervasive than that because we all read an essay on the nature and significance of economic science. And we all followed at that time with keen interest, because there was money in it for us, the recommendations of the Robbins Committee on Higher Education, on which actually Richard Layard was a senior research officer. And then those of us who were taking monetary economics were aware that in the 50s, far ahead of the consensus, Lord Robbins had made the case for the effectiveness of monetary policy, a point that was then much debated, and I think the students were sort of encouraged to think there wasn't much to it, but that point is not now in any doubt. One takes economics increasingly seriously the more one has to apply it. And the last paragraph of Lord Robbins' famous essay on the nature and significance of economic science bears testimony to his belief in the value of our field. That paragraph said, "In the last analysis, economics does depend on the affirmation that rationality and ability to choose with knowledge is desirable." And then his final sentence, "That branch of knowledge which above all others is the symbol and safeguard of rationality in social arrangements, must, in the anxious days which are to come, possess a peculiar and heightened significance. I was actually struck as I read that. I was wondering what anxious days he was talking about. It was the Great Depression, because this was written in 1932. I thought it meant World War II when I first looked at it, but I concluded it was something else. Now, Lionel Robbins, as he then was deeply involved in the discussions and the meetings that led to the creation of the IMF and the World Bank, and he attended the Bretton Woods Conference. So I'm sure that for that reason alone, the topic for this year's Robbins lectures would have interested him. One of my recollections of my life as a student was of attending a seminar at which Robbins read extracts from his wartime diaries. And I remember him on that occasion reading in his sonorous voice a striking paragraph that subsequently appeared in print. I didn't know why I remembered it, but once I found it, I realized why. It is the entry for June the 24th, 1944, about a meeting in Atlantic City with the American delegation, and that was a week before the Bretton Woods Conference started. And here's what he said. Keynes was in his most lucid and persuasive mood, and the effect was irresistible. At such moments, I often find myself thinking that Keynes must be one of the most remarkable men that have ever lived. The quick logic, the bird-like swoop of intuition, the vivid fancy, the wide vision, above all, the incomparable sense of the fitness of words, all combine to make something several degrees beyond the limit of ordinary human achievement. Certainly in our age, only the Prime Minister, and that was Churchill, of course, is of comparable stature. He, of course, surpasses him. But the greatness of the Prime Minister is something much easier to understand than the genius of Keynes. For in the last analysis, the special qualities of the Prime Minister are the traditional qualities of our race raised to the scale of grandeur, whereas the special qualities of Keynes are something outside all that. He uses the classic style of our life and language, it is true, but it is shot through with something that is not traditional, a unique, unearthly quality of which one can only say that it is pure genius. The American sat entranced as the godlike visitor sang, and the golden light played around, and when it was all over, there was very little discussion. In quoting Robbins on Keynes, I'm highlighting not only his own superb style, but also his generosity to a great economist, Keynes, with whom he had earlier substantially disagreed. And it is striking also that in his public activities, including his association with the National Gallery and the Royal Opera House, and his involvement in public policy issues, Lord Robbins had so much in common with Keynes. I'm going to talk about the financial crises of the 1990s and of the reform of the IMF and the international financial system. I've advertised three lectures, but it's actually not going to work out quite that way as far as I can see. I really have two big topics. The one is to talk about the crises themselves and the response, the policy responses to the crises. And the second is about reform of the system. My guess at the moment is that I will get through that this lecture and most of the next one will be about what happened and why, and that the reform of the system will be discussed mainly in the third lecture. I should also clarify that I am still at the IMF as a senior advisor to the managing director, but I'm no longer taking part in policy discussions. So if I answer a question by saying I don't know, that's probably the truth. As I am about to start, I'm reminded of how Lord Robbins had an absolutely standard introduction, as far as I can remember, to all lectures. As I remember, they all started, "I'm sure you're all waiting to hear Professor X speak on topic Y, and I don't propose to stand between you and him a moment longer. and then he would sit down. And that was the standard introduction. Well, I should start and get on with things. And I'm going to talk mainly about the crises of the 1990s. And we're looking at a period between December 1994 and March 1999, during which Mexico, Thailand, Indonesia, Korea, Malaysia, Russia, and Brazil experienced major financial crises, which were associated with massive recessions, most of them, and extreme movements of exchange rates, all of them. The effects of those crises spread to other emerging market countries, and in the fall of 1998 seemed to threaten the stability of the United States financial markets. The course of the crises can be followed in Figure 1, which shows the emerging market bond index spreads for the period 1994 to mid-2001. And we start with the Mexican crisis, which actually broke out at triangular point there, and worsened in terms of its impact on bond spreads all the way until March the 9th. And that is the worst of the average spreads seen since during the 1990s and since. And the spread started coming down after that, pretty much, well into the start of the Asian crisis, because the devaluation in Thailand comes here. And then a few months later, there was an attack on the Hong Kong dollar and the Hong Kong stock market, at which point there was a bit of an upswing in the spreads. This is the Indonesian crisis. Things went up a little bit. And then we get to the attack on Hong Kong, and then spreads really... this is very misleading. I must apologize for here. This is Korea. We have a lot of trouble. This is 10. Yeah. This is the attack on Hong Kong. This is the Korean package. And then, that's the Korean package. I'm sorry, this is mislabeled. And then things go up significantly and get worse and worse through 1998. There's the Russian crisis over here, improving somewhat thereafter. We had trouble in Brazil around here, and then things got better, and only at the end of 2001 did spreads start rising again. So we had a long period of reasonable spreads down here in the period from the beginning of 2000, after Brazil had devalued and the devaluation worked. But notice that things never got back to the point that they were before the start of the Asian crisis. The average spreads were much higher, around 700 basis points, following all these crises than they were before these crises. Now, the point at which things got very, very bad in the global economy was with the Russian crisis in August 1998, and that was followed by a period in which there was a fear that the crisis would impact the global economy, and there's a statement by President Clinton in September 1998, in which he said, "This is the biggest financial challenge facing the world in a half century." I thought that was a bit exaggerated at the time, but it certainly was a lot of fear. And when the IMF and the World Bank met in early October 1998, it was an exceptionally gloomy period, not the less gloomy because the IMF was running out of money and there was no certainty that the Congress, which was the sole remaining institution which had to approve the quota increase, would do so. So we might have been heading into very heavy weather without any ability to make loans. During what you have here is financing from the capital markets for the emerging markets, and you see that the total was higher in 1997 than it's been in any subsequent year, or in fact than it was in any previous year. It came down very sharply in 1998. This is the period when we thought there was a global crisis going on. It came back a little bit in 1999, and then 2000 looked better, as if we were heading back to some higher level. And then these data stop in the first half of 2001, but by now they would be well below where they are. So we're back in a period in which gross flows to the emerging markets are way down from where they are, and net flows are negative to the emerging market countries. Now, this period from 94 to 99 was one in which I had a series of gloomy visions of what could happen, and almost everything I feared could happen bad did happen. And that went on until the Brazilian devaluation in early 1999, which many, including me, feared was going to set off a second round of crises or a third round of crises. But by March 1999, the Brazilian program was working. And at that point, the pall that had been hanging over the emerging markets and the fears that we had had in the IMF and I'm sure elsewhere began to lift. Now, during that period, from the Mexican devaluation to the revised Brazilian program, from the end of 1994 to March 1999, the IMF helped assemble loan packages amounting to almost $219 billion. That's for these six cases that I'm going to focus on: Mexico, Thailand, Indonesia, Korea, Russia, and Brazil. These are the announced sizes of the packages: $48.8 billion for Mexico, $17 for Thailand, etc. I hope you can read them. I'll read them quickly. $36 for Indonesia, $58 for Korea, $16.5 for Russia, and $42 for Brazil, of which in no case except Russia was the IMF providing a majority of the funding, but it was providing very large sums of money in all these crises. Now, despite the scale of these financing programs, most of those countries also suffered very large recessions. Well, I'm going to talk about these six crises. And there are 21st century crises. What does that mean? When the Mexican crisis broke out, Michel Camdessou said, this is the first crisis of the 21st century. Well, I sometimes congratulated him later that we'd had another six crises of the 21st century before it even began. So the financial world was moving very, very fast. But what did it mean that it was a 21st century crisis? It meant there was a capital account crisis driven more by capital account developments than by what was happening in the current account. Now, there were other crises during this period. Turkey in 1994, Argentina in 1995, and Malaysia and the Philippines in 97-98. And I refer to events in some of those countries from time to time, but I'm not going to focus on those. These programs generated a huge amount of controversy, and the controversies were about the economics and the political economy of stabilization and reform programs for countries that turned to the IMF for assistance. There was an intense debate over the role of international capital flows and capital market liberalization. And there was an associated and protracted, and it's still going on, discussion of the reform of the international financial system, which centered largely on the role of the IMF. Now, I'll take these topics up in turn, and I'll start with a summary of the origins and the outcomes of the crises and of the IMF-supported programs that were put in place to deal with them. So let me start with the crises. And this is a story of what happened, and I'll have to go light on war stories. It felt like the wars frequently, but we only have three lectures, so I'm going to have to leave out many of the incidents that happened. Mexico devalued on December the 20th, 1994, and 2 days later was forced to float its currency. That devaluation came as a surprise to many in both the markets and the official sector, despite the fact that Rudy Dornbusch and Alejandro Werner had written a very well-known paper presented at the spring 1994 Brookings panel that ended with the sentence, "A sad ending lies ahead unless the currency is devalued." But it wasn't devalued in time, and we were into a crisis. Now, what caused it? Well, in retrospect, the crisis was generally attributed to the unsustainability of the current account deficit of Mexico, which had averaged more than 7% of GDP in the 3 years 1992 to 94. And in addition, the Mexican budget presented just before the devaluation assumed that the current account deficit in 1995 would be 8% of GDP. Mexican government officials tended to attribute the crisis to a series of adverse and unpredictable shocks, including the assassination of presidential candidate Colosio in March 1994, at which point the reserves, then $30 billion, declined by about $10 billion, and then the Chiapas crisis in November 1994, at which point the reserves declined again by another $10 billion. Now, there were three important lessons drawn from the Mexican crisis at the time. First, there were actually two Mexican programs. The first one was produced very soon after the devaluation, within a matter of days, and it assumed that the external current account deficit would decline from 8% of GDP to 4% of GDP, and that growth would be 1.5%, and that you would get that improvement in the current account and sustained growth, at least the continuation of low growth, by devaluing and by tightening fiscal policy. It became clear that the markets were in no mood to support any current account deficit. There just wasn't the financing for that. And I thought that the plan they'd presented was pretty reasonable, but there wasn't anything you could do to get financing. So the Mexican government reformulated the program in March 1995. They tightened fiscal policy by another 1.5% of GDP, and they wrote down their growth assumption from 1.5% to minus 2%. And it was at that point, it was in figure one, that you saw that the spread of against Mexico kept rising until March the 9th, which was the date that they introduced this new program. And one conclusion you could draw from that was that the markets drew confidence from the fiscal tightening that took place then. Second, at several stages during the crisis when the peso weakened, these are nominal overnight interest rates in Mexico. At several points when the peso weakened, and it did it quite a bit, the Mexican authorities raised interest rates very sharply, and there's a short period here when overnight rates were 140%. Of course, real rates were negative at that point, but the nominal rates were high. And then later, here in late 95, when there was a second crisis in Mexico, they again tightened monetary policy, and at that point they managed to stabilize the situation. And from this, one could conclude that at least in this situation, monetary tightening had worked. The third point, and it's one that I kept having to remember during the crises, was that it took a long time for the Mexicans to regain confidence. As late as November 95, which is a year after the devaluation, the markets were very nervous and the Mexican authorities were simply perplexed. We met with them and they said, we don't know what to do. We're doing everything we said we'd do. We can't see any improvements we're supposed to make in policy. What do you propose we do? Was very hard to figure out. The market participants were saying monetary policy was difficult to understand and wasn't tight enough. That's where you got that tightening of monetary policy. And then the Wall Street Journal explained, following the announcement of the government's economic assumptions for 1996, the trouble is that markets are questioning Mexico's ability to generate economic growth. Well, the markets were questioning, but by that stage, Mexico's recovery was already actually underway. And GDP grew not by 3%, but by 5% in 1996. I say this because there are times when market reactions are very, very difficult for policymakers to understand. You can't change the market's mind. You can try to. You can explain what you think is happening. But once the markets have spoken, there's not a whole lot that one can do. And sometimes one believes, and I believed then, that the markets did have it wrong. The other thing we should take from the Mexican crisis is how serious were the contagion effects it produced. Capital market conditions, this is figure three, for other Latin American countries worsened following the Mexican crisis. These are the spreads on Argentine, Brazilian, and Mexican bonds up to the end of 1994. Mexico is the market favorite, the brown one, down here. Brazil is in least favor with Argentina in the middle. And then comes the Mexican crisis and the Mexican spreads shoot up above the others. But they're moving in lockstep and they stay more or less in lockstep with little changes in relative position until very recently when Mexico has clearly been differentiated by the markets from Argentina and Brazil. And Mexican spreads now are somewhere around just under 400 basis points. But what happened in Mexico affected the rest of Latin America. And in 1995, the Mexican slowdown spread to Argentina, which had negative growth in that year. And then something happened in January 1995. Which was that the Philippine peso and the Hong Kong dollar came under attack in January 1995 as a result of the Mexican crisis, and it seemed almost impossible to understand that. I didn't realize that that was a message, that the Asian miracle was not necessarily bound to stick in the minds of the markets and that there could be pressures in those markets. I just thought it was a mistake. It didn't last more than a few days, incidentally. Now, continuing to the Thai crisis looked very much like the Mexican crisis at the beginning. Thailand was defending a pegged exchange rate. It had a very large current account deficit, 8% of GDP. In both 95 and 96, it had a weak stock market and it had weakening external confidence. This was a crisis that was foreseen, and the Thai authorities were warned repeatedly that they were heading for a crisis, but they didn't take action until their international reserves were essentially exhausted. Eventually, on July the 2nd, Thailand allowed the baht to float. It then depreciated by about 10%, but as nothing else was done, it continued to depreciate. And at the end of July, finally, Thailand requested the support of an IMF program. And that program included measures to deal with serious weaknesses in the Thai financial system. And it was approved in August the 20th, 1997. After the program had been approved, the Japanese Ministry of Finance called together the main Japanese creditor banks of Thailand. And in a meeting with the Thai authorities, those banks agreed to maintain their credit lines in Thailand. Now, one of the most controversial aspects of the Thai crisis, of the Thai program, and one that badly affected the IMF's relations with the Thai authorities, was that the Thais published full data on the reserves and on forward foreign exchange commitments at the start of the program. They had concealed the fact that they had sold forward essentially all their reserves. And the fund insisted, and I should confess that the insistence was particularly strong from our largest shareholder, that that information be made public before there be loans to the, before the loan go into effect. I had some sympathy for the Thai position at the time, namely that they didn't want to announce both an IMF program and that they had no reserves. But I subsequently decided I was quite wrong, and that to have let the program go ahead with incorrect data on the reserves would leave the truth as a sort of Damocles hanging over market confidence and trust in the information that was being given, and that that would have been a very big mistake. And if I had it to do all over again, I would have agreed with the Thais that it was a mistake to reveal the state of the reserves on the day the IMF program went into effect. It should have been announced sooner. And it should have been got out of the way. And then the program could have gone ahead. But this weighed very heavily in the minds of the Thai authorities as something very unfair that had been done to them. I actually think now it was something entirely appropriate. Once the baht had been devalued, there were questions about exchange rate arrangements in neighboring countries, and the Philippine peso was floated a week later. That was a decision taken in agreement with the IMF because the Philippines was in an IMF program at the time. And then, acting preemptively, Indonesia widened its intervention band, and a few days later, the Malaysian ringgit was allowed to float. Nevertheless, the pressures on these currencies continued, and in August, the Indonesian rupiah was also floated. And these currencies were in each case defended by raising exchange rates, though to a lesser extent in Korea, where this is when they started raising rates, and in Malaysia, these scales are not the same, so it's a bit misleading, than they were raised in Thailand. Well, this crisis was taking place. It was very, looking at it in retrospect, it was very odd. There was pressure on, there was a program with Thailand, and there were pressure on the other currencies, but there was little public indication. There was, I guess, there were a few premonitions among policymakers of the storm that was about to break out. Thailand was struggling, but that was fully explicable as a result of the failure of the government to implement its program firmly. So it wasn't obvious that there was a big, big problem coming. Indonesia had a strong fiscal position, had taken preemptive actions on the currency, and they looked like they were doing the right things. And the Indonesians knew that they had a very weak financial sector, and the policymakers were talking to the IMF, looking for a way of having a program to help strengthen the financial sector, but being blocked by the politicians. There had been signs of difficulty in the Korean economy since the start of the year. The Korean stock market kept declining, and there had been several bankruptcies of the chaebols, but Korea was regarded as in a different league from the other ASEAN countries, and especially since it had become an OECD member. I'd noticed in August a newspaper report saying that the Korean government had promised to ensure the payment of foreign debts held by Korean lenders, and I'd wondered why such a guarantee was necessary, but I was never able to nail it down. And I'd also kept on my desk a Wall Street Journal article of August 18th, 1997, quoting the head of foreign exchange for Asia, at a leading investment bank, and what he said was, after the baht, the ringgit, and the rupiah, we feel that maybe we've been neglecting the Hong Kong dollar. We might succeed, you never know. At least we'll see how much the Hong Kong Monetary Authority is willing to spend in its defense. I found this an extraordinary statement, that he was thinking that, I found quite plausible. That he was willing to say that, I found much less plausible. Well, we had the annual meetings of the IMF and the World Bank in Hong Kong in September, following its return to Chinese sovereignty, and everybody thought the world economy was in pretty good shape, aside from the difficulties in Southeast Asia. I was asked by the ASEAN finance ministers and central bank governors to meet with them in a quiet, secret meeting, and they said how worried they were and asked what they could do, and there wasn't a whole lot you could tell them, but they were the only ones who seemed very seriously worried. It was in October that the situation turned from bad to a crisis, and it started when Taiwan devalued on October 17th. Taiwan had huge reserves, and it wasn't clear why they had to devalue, possibly because their exports were way down. And then on October the 20th, the pressure began on Hong Kong, with the hedge funds pursuing a fail-safe strategy of shorting both the Hong Kong dollar and the Hong Kong stock market. And the pressure on the currency would cause interest rates to rise. That would cause the stock market to fall. So whichever position you had, you were going to come out ahead. Maybe they wouldn't devalue the currency, so you wouldn't make it on the short position on the currency, but you would make it on the stock market. And the stock market fell over 25% in that week. We'd been talking to the Indonesians for about a possible precautionary program focused on the financial sector in September, but nobody had felt it was very urgent. But as the crisis worsened, the nature and scope of the discussions changed, and we sent a mission to negotiate a regular standby in Jakarta on October 97. We reached an agreement with Indonesia on October the 31st, and that was agreed by the IMF board on November the 5th. The biggest of the crises was Korea, and the market pressures on Korea were mounting during November. On November the 17th, the Koreans widened their trading band, and a very delicate dance that would lead at the end of the month to negotiations between Korea and the IMF for a program began. It was during this period that we began to discover that Korea's reserves were rapidly becoming exhausted. Finally, on November the 21st, which was a Friday, the Koreans asked for a program. We started negotiating the following Tuesday and following Wednesday and concluded negotiations within a week, at which point Korea had about $2 billion in reserves, having started with $36 billion a few months before. That was the most intense week of negotiations during this entire crisis period, even more difficult than the negotiations with Russia. And on December the 4th, the IMF board approved an approximately $21 billion loan for Korea, of which $5.5 billion became available immediately. And I remember the treasurer of the IMF standing at the door of the executive board room, waiting for the meeting to conclude so that he could go off and wire the money immediately. It was that tough. Now, what caused these crises? Well, at the start, the Indonesian and Korean crises were ascribed, particularly by policymakers in the two countries, to speculative attacks caused by contagion. The fact is, the normal macroeconomic indicators were healthy in both countries, although exports in Korea, as in Thailand, had been hit hard by the slowdown in electronics exports at the end of 96. Both countries, though, had been defending pegged exchange rates, and both had large external, mainly private sector, debts, and the financial sectors in both countries were believed to be very weak. Corporate leverage ratios in Asia varied widely. In a comparison of corporate leverage among 45 countries, including the OECD, leverage, the ratio of total debt to equity, was by far the highest in Korea, with Japan next. And Thailand, Indonesia, and Hong Kong were among the top 10, while Taiwan was among the lowest, and the Philippines, Singapore, and Malaysia also had much lower leverage ratios. So the countries with very weak corporate, or with very, with weak corporate financing structures were, aside from Korea, Thailand, Indonesia, Hong Kong. Indonesia and Thailand were highly vulnerable to a speculative attack, and each suffered one. There's been some discussion in the literature about the nature of the contagion that led to the speculative attacks. The notion that the Thai crisis was a wake-up call, which drew attention of investors to similar difficulties in other countries, I find persuasive, so long as one recalls that the difficulties in Korea had actually been manifesting themselves from the start of 1997. So I think what you had was countries with good macroeconomic situations, but very serious financial sector weaknesses, very, very vulnerable to financial difficulties, and then the financial difficulties came. But in the Thai case and in the Korean case, one should not underestimate what it means to have run a program in which you refused to change policies at all while you paid out all your reserves. That is one of the most extraordinary things I can imagine or I've seen. The sheer fixed state of mind of those who keep on doing the same thing day after day, knowing it's not sustainable and not being willing to change. And then when you hit the wall and you don't have any choice, at that point, all hell breaks loose. You don't know what to do, you don't have a new framework, you haven't taken action, and you have no flexibility left. And that's what happened in those two cases. I think the Indonesian case was different. I'll come to that in a moment. I think both the Russian and the Brazilian crises were much more traditional in nature, for both countries had serious macroeconomic problems at the time of the crisis. Russia had performed very well under an IMF standby agreement in 1995, when it succeeded in sharply reducing inflation through the use of a crawling peg exchange rate anchor. And then in 1996, in March, we reached agreement on an extended fund facility loan before the Russian election. If somebody wants to ask about that later, we can go into that. With the poor health of President Yeltsin, though, performance under the extended fund facility was fitful at best, and we were sometimes disbursing tranches and sometimes not, and it was pretty on and off loan. And the budget deficit for 96 and 97 exceeded 7% of GDP each year in Russia. Government debt was less than 35% of GDP, very small. But with GDP declining and running 7% of GDP deficits, you could see the debt building up very rapidly. Their fiscal sustainability was in doubt and interest rates were rising, which of course added to the doubts on fiscal sustainability. And then in 1998, oil prices declined, and so you had a worsening of both the fiscal situation and the balance of payments. Market confidence in Russia declined further, and the pressures on the exchange rate and interest rates intensified. We started negotiating with the Russians in June 1998 to augment their financing from the IMF and reached agreement on a set of measures and a large-scale financing package in July. This package was described in the press as worth $22.6 billion, of which $15 billion was from the IMF and $6 billion from the World Bank, and the remaining little bit was from Japan. But that included undisbursed amounts already committed under existing facilities. The new conditionality on Russia in 1998 was almost all fiscal, with the intent being to ensure the collection of taxes and to restore to the center some of the revenues that had been lost to the regions. The government lacked a majority in the Duma, and so much of economic policy during the 90s had been implemented by decree, and implemented very badly. But this time the IMF took the view that Duma support for the program was essential, that you could no longer continue with these decrees which were not implemented and then with the political system opposed to the policies the government was trying to implement. And so the program included 10 measures that would have to be approved by the Duma as prior conditions for the $5.6 billion tranche. The Russians also made an attempt with the help of Western advisors to restructure part of their debt to increase its maturity and to reduce its interest cost. Well, in the event, the government did pass 8 out of 10 measures through the Duma, which was far more than it had done at any time up to that point. But since they hadn't passed all 10 measures, the fund reduced the $5.6 billion to $4.8 billion. Furthermore, relatively little debt was exchanged, and therefore the enhanced program was off to a bad start, and market pressures soon intensified. At that point, the Russians asked for more money, and to the surprise, relied on the so-called moral hazard play. The request was refused. And on the weekend of August the 14th to 16th, Russia decided both to devalue and to default on its debt. Now, the Russians had discussed the possibility of either devaluing or defaulting and not doing the other, but concluded that either action would inevitably lead to the other, and they decided they had to do both. The anguished outrage, and it was outrage because we got some of the phone calls, and the massive contagion that resulted suggested that these actions were a surprise to many. But it's very difficult to believe that investors receiving triple-digit dollar returns on their GKOs did not regard the situation as highly risky, even if you take into account the fact, the inevitable fact, that those left holding the GKOs at the end must have been those who most firmly believed that Russia would be able to hold on. Now, in the Brazilian case, Brazil had, I think, what is probably the best executed inflation stabilization ever, with the Plan Real in 1994. And that transited into a pegged exchange rate against the dollar. Brazil was virtually untouched by the tequila crisis in 1995, but the real exchange rate was continually appreciating, and fiscal policy was becoming more expansionary in 95, 96, 97. There were pressures on the currency in 97, but they were beaten back through a high interest rate defense. I think there's 97, and you see those high interest rates. No, that's 99, I'm sorry. 97 is just here. You don't quite see it, but it's there. Now, when the negotiations began with Brazil in September 1998, many called for a devaluation. But the Brazilians argued vehemently that they could not let go of the exchange rate because that would revive inflation, and Brazil had had an inflationary history forever. And then they said the exchange rate was at most overvalued by only 10%. Well, given the delicate state of the emerging markets at that time and the Brazilian opposition to devaluation, the program agreed with the IMF on November the 13th, 1998, supported the pegged exchange rate. It did include an agreement that the rate of crawl would be accelerated and that they devalue by 10% over the coming 12 months, and their policy response was to tighten the budget. Well, the executive board agreed this program in December, despite considerable misgivings expressed by several executive directors, but in the event the peg didn't hold for long and Brazil was forced to devalue in December, in January, and began to float shortly thereafter. It took a while to agree the broad outlines of a new framework for macroeconomic policy, which included inflation targeting. But that was agreed in February, and in March, the new program was approved by the executive board. So let me summarize on the origins of these crises. The Mexican, the Thai, the Russian, and the Brazilian crisis all looked more or less like conventional, old-fashioned crises in which an unsustainable current account combined with a pegged exchange rate to lead to a crisis. However, neither in Mexico nor in Thailand was there a serious fiscal problem. Financial sector weaknesses appeared especially important in Thailand, not least because its financial sector was much larger than that in the three non-Asian crisis countries. This is a fact that is easy to overlook. They save a lot in Asia, and the high Asian savings rate made the financial sectors very big. So the impact of changes in asset prices was much larger proportionately in Asia than it was in countries which had much smaller stocks of financial assets. The crises in Indonesia and Korea looked different from the beginning because both the current account and the fiscal deficits were small and contagion seemed much more important. But the contagion hit economies with serious financial and corporate sector weaknesses, whose impact was magnified as the market pressures increased. Of the six crises, the IMF was called into four of them, Mexico and the three Asian crises, after the pegged exchange rate had been abandoned. In the two other cases, the IMF was lending to help defend a pegged exchange rate, but ultimately neither defense succeeded. In each of the Brazilian and Russian cases, the exchange rate originally been pegged as part of a successful disinflation program. But in neither case did the country succeed in moving out of the peg in time. Now, one lesson you could draw is never defend a pegged exchange rate, but it should be noted that there was a successful defense of a hard-pegged exchange rate during this period. In April 1995, with Argentina in crisis as a result of Mexican contagion, there was an IMF program that helped to maintain convertibility and restore growth in Argentina. And that was a remarkable program because 2 months before a presidential election, they raised taxes very significantly to defend the currency and the stabilization, and the president was reelected. And if there's any doubt about the determination at that time of the Argentines not to give up convertibility, it was resolved by the way that election turned out. Well, I'm going to talk next about the effects of the crises and what I want to do before turning to questions, is just to show how dramatic the effects of the crises, this would be figure six, is that? This is the effect of the crises on growth in the crisis countries. Year T is the year of the crisis. It's a bit hard to date these things because the crises don't all happen at the same month. So there's a little arbitrariness in assigning them to a particular year. But year T is approximately the year the crisis broke out, and it's 1997 for the three Asians. It's 1994 for Mexico. Mexico is in red. You see growth in year T minus one and growth in year T, except in Thailand, and that's because a crisis broke out mid-year. Then you see, for those four countries, tremendous recessions in each of them. Thailand minus 11%, Indonesia minus 13%, Korea minus 7%, and Mexico 6%. That's what happened in the year following the crisis, which are recessions on a scale which are rarely seen, and then recoveries in the next year, except in Indonesia, with Korea rebounding by an extraordinary 11%, 10%, and then Mexico doing what we thought was spectacularly at the time, 5%, and Thailand about 4%. There were two cases that were different. They were Brazil and Russia. Russia did have a big loss in income in the year of the crisis, but this came quite late, and Russia, this little purple thing you see here is the only year that Russia grew from 1991 to 1997, so it was hardly deeply based growth. Brazil was doing pretty well. Then comes the year of the crisis. Brazil did not have a year of negative growth despite its crisis. And then Russia rebounded very rapidly indeed, and Brazil came back pretty fast. So these two are slightly different cases. Of course, in the Russian case, oil prices turned so remarkably in their favor that too had a positive impact. But these are different than those crises in terms of their impacts on growth. Well, what I want to do in the next lecture is go through the other effects of these crises and then explain what the programs looked like and why the programs took the form they did. And then at the end of that lecture, I'll conclude with some reflections on the crises, with some reflections on crisis management that I gleaned in the past 7 years, and then I'll answer the catch-22 question, which is, if you had it to do all over again, what would you do differently? It's a catch-22 question, because if you say nothing, they say, well, you see, he hasn't learned a thing. And then when you say, well, I'd have done this, that, and the other differently, they say, aha, you made a mistake. So there's no way of winning that one. Needless to say, we made mistakes. Needless to say, they're not quite the same mistakes that, or I don't regard them in the same light as some of the critics do, and that's what we're going to talk about in the next lecture. Let's take some questions now. Way back there. Oh, you need a mic.
Marcus has got the machine.
Oh, sorry, there's one downstairs. Yeah. You're next. Marcus?
Can you switch it on? What's the mistake? Stand up, Marcus.
I'll repeat the question for you.
What's the mistake?
The question is, was the mistake premature capital account liberalization? And I'll have to give a complicated answer to that one. I don't think it was premature in Korea. I think it was done wrong in Korea. The opening at the short end first and not opening at the long end, and similarly in Thailand. So mistakes in capital account liberalization, yes, but premature, not necessarily. But we'll come back to discuss that next time. Way back there.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Two questions. First, your notes and especially the diagrams look very interesting, so I don't know if there's any way that you can publish them on the website of the LSE.
I'll as soon as I get the dates recalibrated so that they match up to where they're supposed to be, I'll do that. I'll do it at the end of these lectures after reading them again.
Okay, thank you. And the second question is, I don't know if you're willing to comment on that, but you know, one of the most current questions is how does the current crisis compare with the previous crisis that you mentioned, and you know, can you make any parallel between the unprecedented situation right now and any of the crises that you mentioned or any previous ones in the financial markets and in the global economy?
Well, these are crises mainly about emerging markets, and Marcus has stolen half of my my second lecture, and you're about to steal half of my third lecture. So let me try and answer that indirectly in the third lecture, and I promise to recognize you first in that lecture, and we can go through it again. Okay? Let's take one downstairs.
This pertains to Japan. According to you, what are the two or three most important reasons for the state of the Japanese economy, one? And secondly, what ought to be done to get the interest rates perhaps to some sort of a positive figure?
I could try to answer that, but I think I should take one that's sort of more related to the subject of this lecture. There we are.
Hi. You held up earlier an example of a successful intervention in a currency board system with 1995 defense of the Argentine peg. I was wondering whether, in light of what's been going on over the past few days, you'd still see it as a successful defense. Because just before I came, I saw FRBs down at 54, so they fell about eight and a half big figures today. It's thought that Argentina is going to default over the next 2 days. It looks like they have nowhere to go, and I was just wondering whether you thought that the defense of the currency board back in 95 is a contributory factor to that.
Well, I mean, that was a successful defense of the currency board. I think Argentina's current problems come from later developments, in particular fiscal policies at the end of the 90s. And they could have run a different set of policies and sustained the currency board. Obviously, if they were floating now, they'd be floating now, and they wouldn't be having to defend the currency board. But at the time, when they did that, there was a firm conviction on their part that they needed to defend the peg to maintain their inflation record. They had very good growth in the next 3 years after 95. So I don't think that it was inevitable from that date that the currency board was doomed, and I think they could have maintained it if they'd been willing to run a different set of fiscal policies. And a currency board puts very, very tight pressure, very strong constraints on fiscal policy. And if you're not going to accept those constraints, then you're going to have a problem. And so I that's the answer to that one. Over here. Could you just pass that down, please? Well, you could speak now. Okay,
in the fall of 93, the Mexican finance minister in this hall gave three lectures. They may have been the Lionel Robbins lectures. And he actually painted a glowing picture of both the liberalization program and economic performance. And I wonder if you would know what it is that the minister and his colleagues were looking at that was different from what Professor Dornbusch and his colleague was looking at.
Yeah, first of all, they were looking at the fact that they had actually improved fiscal policy enormously. And Mexico, which had had chronic fiscal problems for a very long time, had finally gotten its budget in shape. Secondly, their current account deficit was being financed to a great extent by long-term capital inflows at that point. Thirdly, they had NAFTA, and they were liberalizing in that direction. And then they brought out an argument which always makes me a little nervous. They were arguing that the current account deficit was caused largely by imports of investment goods which were bound to pay for themselves. And so it wasn't the same as a current account deficit caused by imports of consumption goods. I used to find that argument very attractive, but I've discovered that it turns out it's almost always seems to be the case when you raise the issue with the country that that's the case. So I'm a little less accepting of that thing then. There were major changes in the Mexican economy, and I am sure that the fact that Mexico was growing again within a year after that profound a crisis indicates that something very different had happened relative to what happened to them in the 1980s, when it took them 4 or 5 years to get back to serious growth. Let's take one upstairs and then one downstairs. I take it on the grounds of distributive fairness, there should be two upstairs for one downstairs, which is.
You mentioned a few times the difficulties either of complying to programs by the fund or by policies that were unsustainable. And I wonder analytically what lessons you draw, not in terms of how to reform and make it better in the future, but analytically, where you see the difficulties in implementing the correct policies. Are these matters of ignorance? Are these matters of political economy? And what is the nature behind these difficulties for you?
Well, it depends on the context, but in several of these cases, they were political economy issues. You had governments which couldn't bring themselves to do what needed to be done, and frequently I suspect they knew what needed to be done. So I would say primarily political economy in several of these cases. There may have been other things when you're in a situation where, say, debt sustainability is uncertain. You tend to look for the optimistic scenario, and that's a natural tendency of everyone. And then there's a tremendous tendency to, if you know that what you have to do is very, very difficult and an uncertain outcome, to postpone taking action. That's political economy. It's also a bit just human nature. And so it's a combination of those things. I don't think that policymakers we interact with are that ignorant about things. I mean, you show them your calculations as to why something is not sustainable, and they say it's very interesting. My suspicion is they know damn well what you're telling them, but they'll have a good long argument with you because you know, they'd rather get more money or something like that. So I don't put a lot of weight on ignorance. My guess is it would take actually a psychologist to figure. No, but this is not a. This is not. This is a serious comment. To understand the mindset of people who get into a set of policies that they know cannot continue. Probably cannot continue very long and continue doing them. Maybe they want force majeure to make them do things. I don't know. But it's a very interesting question to which I don't have the answer. There was someone back there.
Am I allowed a question?
The last time you asked me a question in a course, Richard, it was about why the Phillips curve slopes as a negative slope. It took about 20 miles of walking to get you to agree. You could understand why it didn't have a positive slope. I think we never got you to the negative slope, but go ahead.
No, I just wanted to push you a bit more on Russia, because my recollection is that in April, 6 months before the crisis, the interest rates were perfectly okay, like 25%. Real interest rates 5 to 10%, a current account imbalance, and there was a very dangerous world situation out there. And I mean, you explained your approach very well there, that you decided this was the moment to tighten up on the Russians. And I just wonder, I mean, maybe it came out okay, but don't you think it was rather dangerous?
Well, I mean, you're talking about April and we're talking about July, and in July interest rates were in the triple digits.
No, but I didn't make my other point. They went up step by step every time your representative came out of a meeting and said something, up they went.
I think if you did the sums, Richard, which we did, the ones he asked about the debt sustainability calculations, and looked at budget deficits of 7 and 8% of GDP with growth at 0.5% or less, you had a debt situation that was simply not going to last any length of time. And the budget was nowhere near balance in 98, and that situation, I don't think it had a prayer of continuing for very long unless they straightened out the debt dynamics. Now, if they'd been growing at 10%, then all that was possible, but it wasn't at the time. So I think they had a program. They were not carrying out, as you know, most of the program. And I don't think that putting in a lot more money at any of those stages, unless they took action on the budget and got rid of those huge budget deficits, was going to produce a sustainable situation. And by the time we finished with Russia, they owed us $20 billion. So there's a question of who was going to put in the money and whether they should, and whether that game of short-run financing through the GKOs made any sense. I didn't think it did. Yeah.
I was intrigued by the tenses that you used in your answer to the question on Argentina, because the second part certainly gave me the impression that, in your opinion, the currency board is doomed. It's gone. You said, if I'm correct, they could have maintained it if they'd run a different set of fiscal policies. And that sort of suggests that it isn't maintainable.
Yeah, well, I was never very good on tenses. They're in an extremely tough position. It's clearly going to take a very tough set of policies to deal with the current situation. It does not mean that the currency board will not be maintained, and I think that is maintenance of the currency board is one of the options they take very seriously, and which I think is something that many there want to do. Now, you know, whether the whole policy package hangs together is another question. But when you discuss with the Argentines currency arrangements, whatever changes they may be willing to consider, they're not willing, by and large, to go very far from the currency board. They talk about dollarization, which is really an intensification of the currency board as much as anything. So if I implied that the currency board was bound to disappear, or at least that convertibility, and Cavallo always emphasizes convertibility, namely that you can take your peso and get a dollar, or whatever the mixture of dollars and euros is, if I implied that was going to end, I don't know that, and I'm not at all sure that's the case, and I don't think the Argentines have made that decision either. And there's a strong group there that want to maintain convertibility. Last one.
The old-fashioned type of colonialism was imported by Western military forces. It's been suggested that a new type is developing through the...
It's been suggested a new type of colonialism has developed through the good offices of the World Bank and the IMF, and that is a voluntary acceptance of colonialism
Would you think this is a reasonable comment?
Well, it sounds like a very reasonable exam question with discuss at the end of it. It's very hard to sort of go way down deep into that question. It's pretty clear that this is voluntary. Countries don't have to come to the IMF. They don't have to stay in the international financial system. They can impose capital controls, run themselves through the trading system which they could do without having open capital markets, and they choose not to. And you have to believe, and I do believe, that while policymakers make mistakes, they also have some pretty good appreciation of what is in the interests of their country. I've been immeasurably struck by the fact that although there were many academics and many others urging countries to close their capital accounts in this crisis, and this was a severe crisis, almost nobody did. And Malaysia did impose capital controls, but has got rid of them. And so I don't, you know, there must be some analysis which says somewhere that the leaders of countries are doing the wrong thing and would then support your view, or at least the question you ask. But I don't know how to react to it in a way that, other than to say that I don't see that, I don't see it in that way. But then I'm not the person who would see it in that way.
I think we shouldn't stand between the speaker and his dinner. This has been a most marvelous start, I must say. An incredible survey, beautifully done. We're really looking forward to the answers to all the questions that you postponed.
Thank you.
So same time here tomorrow and the following day. Please let Stan escape before you move downstairs.